Good morning, everybody. I instinctively get up in the morning and reach for my glasses, and I can't see with my glasses anymore, having had cataract surgery. So I feel naked without regular glasses on, but I have these nice drugstore reading glasses until my eyes settle in a little bit. We're up at the tail end of the opening chapters of Genesis, which, in fact, we're coming now to the Table of Nations. It's a very important part of the Bible. The biblical account of the early history of mankind is the only reliable, accurate historic account we have of the early history of mankind. We have legends and myths and fairy tales, but we don't have any accurate information from archaeology or from history, hardly at all, back in this time period. So this is a very, very important document that has been left to us on the early human race. We really should look a little bit at chapter 9 to make sure that we covered it all. Remember, the flood lasted about a year, during which time all life on earth was destroyed. This meant probably many billions of people. We don't know anything about what kind of infrastructure was there at that time. How people live in big cities? Did they have skyscrapers? Was there an advanced technology? Did they have television? Did they have spaceships and go to distant planets? What kind of educational system did they have? People living 900 years have a lot of time, a lot of leisure time probably, a lot of time to go visit relatives, and you'd soon have lots of relatives. One major continent, probably uniform climate year-round, very favorable for life. Plenty of violence, crime, man's inhumanity to man. In fact, that got so bad that provoked God into destroying the whole lot, the whole place. I wish we knew more about that time period. It would be very interesting. We're going to have to talk to the people who came to the Lord before the flood and get their accounts. Now, it's possible the ark is somewhere up in the mountains of eastern Turkey. It's possible. Mount Ararat has had all kinds of expeditions of people climbing there and digging around in the ice. I have a couple of friends that have been there. And climbed all over the places. Mount Ararat's a volcanic mountain, and I tend to think it may be a mountain that formed after the flood, in which case it's not likely to have the ark there. But who knows? The ark was a plenty impressive boat. It was covered with pitch inside and out, so as if it was meant to be protected and last. So I don't know. God doesn't tend to leave lots of evidence lying around. That doesn't tend to help people believe, actually. If Noah's Ark was found, it would be a little sensation in the newspaper for a day or two, and then everybody would forget about it, and all the skeptics would rant and rave about this funny boat up there that somebody built, and it would all go away. Anyway, in chapter 9, we find that God made a new covenant appropriate to life after the flood. There were only 8 survivors. All the people on the earth were heavily evangelized. The New Testament says Noah was a great evangelist. Enoch, 2 generations before, was an evangelist. No way of knowing how many people came to know God during that time period by faith, same way we do. Probably many. But in the 100 years or so while the ark was being built, and while the whole world had an opportunity to get on board the group that was going to leave on the ark, nobody came. And that would say that human hearts were hardened and set against God even more so than they are right now. So when it came time to get on the ark, there were only 8 people. This also means that genetically the human race throttled way down, because we started out with the genome of Adam and Eve, and then it all funneled down at Noah, so we all now carry the genome of Noah. And this has even come up in modern genetics. But, of course, no modern secular geneticist would dare to bring up the possibility of the flood and Noah but the evidence is there even in the genetics. Now, it's quite likely that before the flood, Noah had a comfortable home up in the hills. He might have had a very nice ranch house, and don't know. But life was probably pretty comfortable for everybody, like it's comfortable for us. After the flood, all that's gone. All the roads are gone. The internet's down. There are no airplanes flying. There's no automobiles left. There's no skyscrapers. There's no supermarkets. There's nothing there to support the fancy lifestyle that probably existed on the earth at that time. It's getting out of, off the ark. Things are starting green. Things are coming up out of the ground. And we take animals off the ark, but there's only one way to make a living, and that's to do farming and take care of the animals. And everybody's got to pitch in and work. And make your own clothes, grow your own food. Family size will increase slowly, and eventually you'll get enough descendants of Noah and his sons to build small villages and towns and to, for the human race to spread. By the time of Abraham, which is about 1,500 years after the flood, the world population might have been 1 million or so. Is crawling back up again. When you begin to get a lot of people, then you can have towns and stores, and not everybody has to be raising their own food. Right now in the world, maybe, 5% of the workforce is devoted to raising food for the rest of us, which means that we're pretty fragile. As the internet went down, and we no longer, supermarkets couldn't order their foods, and the trucks couldn't run, and the grocery stores wouldn't open, we could be in bad shape in a couple of weeks' time. We're very fragile as a society. One of the terrorism threats is the possibility of an enemy terrorist launching a rocket halfway over the middle of the country at 40,000 feet with a nuclear explosion, which put out an EMP, an electromagnetic pulse, just one little burst of intense electromagnetic energy, which would take out all the chips, all the semiconductors in every automobile and every computer, shut our whole society down, presto, just like that. And where would we be? It would be a dark day. The escape hatch in Noah's day was to get on board the boat. Our escape hatch is to get into Christ, to find refuge in Him, and where we'll be taken totally care of. So you want to make sure that part of your future is planned and down pat. The new covenant with that God makes with Noah and with all of nature guarantees that the earth will never be destroyed by a flood again. It guarantees that seasons would be uniform and there would be no catastrophes in nature as great as the catastrophe of the flood had been. So there's a guarantee of God's protection at that time. Men are allowed now to eat meat, provided the blood is drained out of it. And that meant that before the flood, the whole world was vegetarian. Animals and man only ate vegetables. And all of you who think that that's an adequate diet, that's correct. You can survive very well on vegetables only. But you don't have to. We get the first hints of government at the time in the covenant with Noah. The first hints that God would like to govern people not just through heads of families. Before the flood, heads of families have the final say. If you've got a dispute, the head of one family deals with the head of another family. But God wants to see that justice takes place on the earth between individuals, and that's gradually going to require the institution that we call government that's provided for us. It's described in Romans what God expects of government, to maintain law and order in an evil society. We have the rainbow was given as a sign of this new covenant. The rainbow suggested it might not have rained beforehand, and that every time you see the rainbow, you're to remind yourself of God's protection of His creation and of people and of animals and of nature. Because He loves all of these. So that's kind of what chapter 9 is about. So Noah gets off of the ark, and first thing he does is have the sacrifice to God, thankful for their deliverance from the catastrophe of the flood, and grateful for a fresh new start, as we would be, and anxious now to get on with building a new society. So climate's reasonably good. You get out of the ark. Probably the ark had enough provisions to get you going. Maybe some seeds and maybe some extra implements for tilling the ground. Okay? Chapter 9, that's kind of what I've given as a summary of chapter 9. Chapter 9 closed with that incident of Noah getting drunk. Probably accidentally. He's not condemned for getting drunk. He just got drunk accidentally on a hot summer day. And maybe there was no fermentation of grape juice before that. We don't know. Or maybe the fermentation rate was less. And then the incident of the youngest son, Ham, going into his father's tent and seeing his father naked and running out and boasting to his brothers and to the family, which was a great shame, brought great shame on the patriarch, who should be treated with honor and respect in that day as in this culture. And when Noah finds out that this has happened, that he's been disgraced by his youngest son, he gets the family together and has a little analysis. And instead of chewing out a Ham for what Ham did, he addresses his remarks to Ham's son, Canaan. And he essentially says that the consequences of all this are going to show up in Canaan's generation. This is one of those sins of the fathers, visit themselves on subsequent generations until the next generation, until the fourth generation. In other words, there's some weakness that that Noah could see in Ham that he saw was even greater in his son Canaan. You often see that in a family, that the weakness in a father will show up in one of the sons to a greater degree, a drunkenness or immorality or something like that. But we don't have to guess, because we know about Canaan. That one son of Ham was the progenitor of the Canaanites, who settled in the promised land and became extremely ungodly in the next centuries up ahead. Totally disregarded any thought of marriage, of sexual fidelity. That's, Sodom and Gomorrah were Canaanite cities. Plenty of sex, drugs, rock and roll running around in these ungodly, lawless communities. So bad that they were beyond the reach of God's grace and had to be destroyed. Remember, God gave them an extra 400 years to repent, and none of them did. And then they were to be utterly wiped out. And the kind of contagious disease they carried, whether it's spiritual or physical, was so great they were to be utterly exterminated, utterly. And the disobedience of the Jews in not utterly exterminated the Canaanites caused big problems all down through the subsequent history of Israel. It's a picture of, for us, of dealing with the old flesh that we all brought into this world. Deal with all of it. Don't save bits and pieces of your old life. Let it all go to the cross. So that's where we have chapter 9. Now, that's sort of stuck in there. We're supposed to just sort of put this story of Canaan in the back of our mind while we go on with chapter 10. So we do find the death of Noah in verse 28. After the flood, Noah lived 350 years. All the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. That's the "and he died" that we had so many times repeated in chapter 5 earlier. He's living up around 900 years, but very shortly the patriarchs will all live less. The lifetimes now will drop. Nobody knows exactly why. Something biologically happened. Also, you can think of the judgment of God that's shortening down the lifetimes. How old was Abraham when he died? 175. How about Moses? 120? Moses is easy. 40 plus 40 plus 40. The three, okay. So the lifetime dropped down to, what is the biblical norm for life now? Moses tells us in 70 or if by reason of strength, 80. That's in the Psalm of Moses, number 90, is it? 90, okay. So if we're over 70, we're doing well, and some of us are. Some of you are doing great. Amen. And God is very good. Now, the sons of Noah are always mentioned, almost always mentioned in the same order, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. That's not their oldest, middle kid, and youngest kid. They're put in that order for a good reason. And we mentioned briefly last time that each one of these boys, these sons, had a specialty, was called to exemplify an aspect of human life that's familiar to all of us. But in order to understand man, you need to understand what these three sons each bring to the table, as it were. I hinted at this last time, but let's do a little quiz. The Synoptic Gospels suggest that there is a message in the Gospels for Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and if so, what are those examples? Is there a Gospel to Shem, and a Gospel to Ham, and a Gospel to Japheth?
Matthew.
Yep, Matthew, Mark, John. Matthew, Mark, Luke. Pardon me, not Matthew, Mark, Luke. John is the Gospel to all mankind. Matthew, the Gospel to the Semitic peoples, to the Jews. Mark is the Gospel to servants, slaves. And Jesus himself is the example of being a great servant. And Luke, that's Japheth, the Japhethites. Luke, the Greek physician. Now, when Jesus was born, were there three classes of visitors who came to see him? If so, did they represent these Shem, Shem, Ham, and Japheth? If so, what are who are the visitors?
The kings of the East,
which could be probably... well, what other groups do you think of?
The shepherds.
The shepherds were there. So the shepherds would be most likely be Semitic, wouldn't they? What other group was in town at that time that shows up as mentioned in John's Gospel?
Zechariah, the priest.
Well, he'd already be there. That'd be one of the Jews. How about some Greeks? Are there some Greeks visiting at that time? Yeah, there's Greeks. So the wise men then...
It was the Roman Empire that existed at that time there, so that's the Western civilization.
Yeah, Western civilization is represented. Shem, Ham, and Japheth are represented as paying tribute to Jesus when he was born, to the coming of the Messiah. The Messiah comes for all mankind, for all groups of people everywhere. The preaching of the gospel. When the gospel first went out to the world, was it only to the Jews? And if not, what was the general order in which the gospel was sent to people after the resurrection? Who was one of the first people that the gospel was taken to? Cornelius, down in Joppa. What about the Ethiopian treasurer? What about him? Which tribe is he?
Ham.
He's a Hamitic guy. And then how about a Roman centurion? Could we throw one of those in there? Yeah, we could. Okay. Did these three sons these three sons of Noah have a role in the crucifixion?
Yes.
That's a good one. It means that the responsibility for the death of Jesus is on all our heads, everybody. It's not just the Jews. What role did the three sons of Noah play in the crucifixion?
Rome.
We've got plenty of Romans running around. The Jewish people. What did the Jewish people as a whole say? Let his blood be upon us. That's how they wrote him off. And did somebody carry his cross? Who? A Hamitic friend.
Simon.
Yes, Simon the Cyrene. Mm-hmm. which is, anyway, now, I got these illustrations from a book here that's one of my favorite books. I'll call your attention to Arthur Custance was around back in the 70s and wrote a whole bunch of doorway papers, which he would mail to people. Ray Steadman used to get them, and I'd get them, and Ray and I would talk about them. Noah's Three Sons is extraordinarily good. It's just really just full of insights into these sons of Noah. It's very, very rich. This has been out of print a long time ago, but you can go to the Custance website, custance.org, and the book's there, so you can read it. On my website is another book, this one by a guy from England, Bill Cooper, After the Flood. What Bill Cooper's book is interesting is that he follows Japheth all the way down to the kings of England, to the early history of our Western civilization, way into the kings, showing that it's continuous. And that's on my website, and these are neat studies if you're at all into history. Now, let's look. This is going to be a class participation, because in chapter 10 we have a whole bunch of names here, and what I need you to do is to see if you can pick out any names here that seem to strike a chord as to modern nations, modern places. Now here in chapter 10, oh, by the way, opening verse of chapter 10, these are the generations of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Sons were born to them after the flood. That's another one of these breaks in the authorship. That's a Toledot break. In other words, the previous section was written by Noah, and he's handed the pen and pencil, the computer laptop over to his son. Which son do you suppose is going to write down the section that follows? Shem. And in fact, the section on Shem is going to be more important, because that's going to lead to the Messiah in the long run. And God doesn't care too much about things that don't lead directly down towards the Messiah. They just sort of go off on the sideline. We'll find out when we get to heaven. And let's see what we can find here. So Shem's going to write here, and he tells us, he's not keeping track for an awful long generation. They're all busy having their own families and raising their own food. But in verse 2, the sons of Japheth are, and there's seven of them, Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javan, Tubal, Meshech, and Tyrus. Probably any of those at all in there that ring a bell? Magog. Okay, we have Magog in the New Testament in Ezekiel. And Magog is north of Jerusalem. It's Gog and Magog, you know, that invade Israel in the last days. Gog is way north, and Magog is probably between Israel and Russia. The Medes. How about the Medes? That's where we get the Medes from. Gomer. Germany. Gomer is associated with Germany. Magog, Madai, Javan, Greece. That happens to, we'll see if we can figure out some of these a little later on. Some of these are place names to this very day, especially if you get an old map. Sometimes your old Bible, will have these, the table of the nations in the back of it. Your handout today, I got carried away and photocopied a bunch of stuff, including a couple of charts and maps to help you with this. It's worth tracing some of these peoples down. The sons of Gomer, we decided that Gomer was in general about Germany. Ashkenaz, what is an Ashkenazi Jew? Jew born in Germany. So that's Ashkenaz is a name that refers to Germany. Riphath. If your charts give a hint, you can. The Carpathians. Yeah, this particular, I think I gave you this full-page table with the impossible printing on it. You can't read. And I can't even read with my glasses, my new glasses. Riphath is the Carpathians. Togarmah is the Armenians. So those are peoples we know about. We're talking about Europe then, aren't we? We're talking about going from Israel, you're talking about going westward and northward, and off into Russia and Europe. That's the Japhethic civilization, okay? The sons of Javan, Elisha, Tarshish you should know from the New Testament, Kittim and Dodanan. From these, the coastland peoples spread. The word coastland in the Old Testament means the islands, the faraway places, the places that are farthest from Israel. We are in the coastlands because we're about as far from Israel as you can get, 9,000 miles or so. These are the sons of Japheth in their lands, each with its own language by their families in their nations. Notice how that a patriarch, a family, head of a family, with his relatives are all going to settle down in an area, and eventually the families will nudge up against one another and they'll have intermarriage. But in general, families sort of plant where they're bloom where they're planted, and eventually you get a nation. Now this list here ends up being a list of 70 nations, and that's commented on in Deuteronomy that the Jewish people would be associated with 70 Gentile nations. Prophetic significance, yeah.
Does verse 5, when it says, "Meet everyone according to his language, look forward to the
yes.
battle"?
Yes, it does. Because at this point, Earth, everybody speaks the same language at this point. So there's no problem communicating. Everybody speaks the same language. But they haven't even been far enough to get local dialects and local slang generated. The Tower of Babel, which we'll get into next week, is the time that the languages are all divided and God comes down and splits up the language to disunite the world from coming together too quickly. Okay. It's worthwhile if you want to look up these words a little bit more to get an idea of some of these groups. Verse 6, the sons of Ham. Now Ham, we already talked about Canaan, who is his fourth son. Ham has sons Cush, Egypt, Put, and Canaan. The word for Egypt is, I mean, your Bible may be Mizra or Mizraim. Long time I had a bank account in the bank Mizra in Cairo when I was working on the pyramids. So that old word Mizra is interesting. So the Egyptian people are descended from a man named Mizra. They've kept their identity. They're not Arabs. They are descendants of Ham. Cush, what about Cush? Ethiopia, okay. There are two Ethiopias in the Bible, by the way. There's the Ethiopia that's south of Egypt, and there's another Ethiopia that's a little more obscure that's up around north of Iraq. That only comes up in a prophetic passage in Isaiah a little bit later on, not terribly important. The sons of Cush were Seba, Havilah, Sabta, Raama, and Sabtika. You can look on your cheat sheet over there. It says, doesn't say very much about them. Okay. We come now to Cush became the father of Nimrod. At Nimrod, we get another signal flag to stop and pay attention because this man is important. It says of Nimrod, he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Now, that doesn't mean that he was really good at hunting pheasants and ducks and geese and deer and wild game. It's a term that's very derogatory. It means that he exploited and hunted down men. That he broke away from God and wanted to start his own world civilization. And it didn't have nothing to do with the religion of his fathers. And he ran out and started building cities. The first of one is Babel or Babylon. Then he built some other cities in that immediate era, Erech and Akkad, all of them in the land of Shinar. Shinar is modern-day Iraq, ancient Babylon. Nimrod, then, is the first man to build a city after the flood. Who's the first man to build a city before the flood? Cain, the condemned murderer. So that's here the great city that's going to come up after the flood the city of Babylon is going to be built by a bad guy who hates Jehovah and wants to do his own civilization. Man rebelling and wanting to be his own God and building great tower and so on. He probably built the Tower of Babel, as we'll see. And he's very ambitious. From that land, he went into Assyria and built Nineveh. Assyria is north, the northern part of Iraq up by Mosul. And he also built Nineveh. Nineveh is right at Mosul, modern town of Mosul. Rehoboth, Both-ir, Calah, and Rezin, between Nineveh and Calah, this is the great city. All on that whole Tigris-Euphrates river basin, he's building cities all over the place. This is why one of the reasons why that area is called the Fertile Crescent. The land between those two rivers is rich and fertile, more so probably back then in those days. Very easy for the human race to cluster around in cities, houses made out of mud brick, and there's no reason to go travel great distances yet. So the whole world population is going to be clustered around that Fertile Crescent area. Okay? We're going to have climate change now. The earth has had a massive jolt from the flood. It's probably lurched around on its axis a little bit. We're going to find out a little later on there's reason to believe that one continent split up and the pieces drifted apart. There are a lot of volcanic activity now. There's climate and weather changes, some catastrophes that will destroy the dinosaurs, and the earth is unstable for 500 years. Big ice age in there someplace or other. I don't think anybody's figured this out from a biblical point of view.
I think I heard that someplace down near Chile, as a result of this recent earthquake, moved like 6 feet up or something. So it's an example of a big movement
of the crust, and then it changes the earth's rotation on its axis even a little bit, or even the tilt. And that's an earthquake by today's standards was a big earthquake, but not by ancient standards. Some of the upheavals after the flood must have been horrendous with that amount of water moving around. Just we have no trace of the earth as it was before the flood. The topography today is all of this big disaster field from overturned mountains and valleys and all buried. The evidence of the old civilizations all buried. Let's see, where did I stop? From Resen, between Nineveh and Calah, is a great city, Egypt. And we moved from Tigris-Euphrates back to Egypt. He was the father of Ludim, Anamim, Leviam, Naphtuim, Pathrusim, Kalushim, and hence come the Philistines and Captorim. So there we get, that's interesting little note, that the Philistine people that are going to settle along the coastlands of Israel and cause a lot of trouble all the way down to King David, those are all, they're come out of the man that founded Egypt, Mizra. Canaan also became the father of Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth, and the Jebusites, the Amorites, the Girgashites, the Hivites, the Arkites, the Sinites, the Arvavites, and the Zemarites, and the Hamathites. Now, did you ever read that list before? Yeah, that list shows up in the account of the conquest of the land by Joshua and the time of the judges and the time of the kings. Those Canaanite tribes are all listed there. They all sort of stayed together. They're all corrupt. They're all bad. The Jews were under no conditions to intermarry with the Canaanites. They would have nothing to do with them, to not get into any of their idolatrous customs. They were also very, very idolatrous people. Open worship of idols. And temple sex temples and so on. Canaan became the father of Sidon. Did I read that? I did, yes. The territory of the Canaanites extended from Sidon. You know where Sidon is? That's southern Israel. It's one of the cities of the Philistines later on. Tyre and Sidon, up north. That's in the north. In the direction of Gerar, as far as Gaza, all the way along the coast of what's today Israel. In the direction of Sodom and Gomorrah, Admah and Zeboiim. Sodom, Gomorrah, Admah and Zeboiim, those are four of the five cities of the plain. Those would be down below the Dead Sea, as far as I could tell. That's where Lot decided to settle because it was green and lush down there at the time. And Abraham, his uncle, settled up at Hebron. Okay. These are the sons of Ham by their families, their languages, their lands, and their nations. Don't you wish we had volumes and volumes of books on each one of these people? You could go read all about them, and we only here and there do we recognize the name. It's all funneling down now to Shem. Or we're going to get down to the line that really matters. This is the line through which the Messiah will come. To Shem also, the father of all the children of Eber. Eber is a little clue. We should know what the word Eber, what group does that refer to? Hebrews. That's where we get the word Hebrew. So we get that little name Eber up there, and that tells us that the Hebrew people are going to come down through that line. The elder brother of Japheth, children were born. The sons of Shem were Elam, Asher, Arpachshad, Lud, and Aram. The sons of Aram were Uz, Hul, Gether, and Mash. Arpachshad became the father of Shelah. Shelah became the father of Eber. To Eber were born two sons. The name of the one was Peleg, for in his days the earth was divided, and his brother's name was Joktan. Now, on that one little phrase there, in his days the earth was divided, has come up a whole controversy that it was in the days of Peleg that the earth split in two and the continents flew apart. That's an awful lot to read into that one verse, isn't it? It's a lot. However, the word Peleg is a more common word than you might imagine. We have the word Peleg today in archipelago. And pelagic deep, the deep depths of the ocean are called the pelagic deep. Archipelago with the islands at sea. The Hawaiian archipelago. That's with, for example. Now, if the earth, this is splitting up, could have been a splitting up associated with the Tower of Babel. It could have been a splitting up for political reasons. But it's kind of entertaining to think that this was something happened in that day that caused the earth to fracture along the lines, the fault lines, and the continents to split up and drift apart. That's just, this would have been about 150, 200 years after Noah got off the boat, yeah.
I'm going to ask you in verse 21, I don't know if it's my translation, but is it referring to Shem as Japheth's older brother?
Yeah, it seems to be there, and it seems to be inconsistent with what I've been telling you all along, that Japheth was the older one. I was going to look that up this morning, and I forgot to resolve that. Maybe I'll see if I can find it. I trust Custance, and it's from Custance, and it's from Ray Stedman that I get that I got my order of ages. Now, there's not a single mention of any women in here at all. Is this something missing? Yeah, something's missing. Why in the world? Don't you think there were women in there making tremendous contributions to civilization? Who's doing all the work while the men are out playing golf? Well, yeah, we just have to see the economy of the Bible. And the notice the focus is narrowing down all the time as we go along, the focus. All sorts of things you'd like to know about all these peoples, and they're just not carried forward. The focus is always going to narrow back down so that we get on the line of Shem and we're headed towards the Messiah.
It sort of adds an additional emphasis in chapter 12 when the Lord shall save Abraham, he will make his name great. All these other names are written.
That's true. Yes, if any of these people had been very significantly godly, or had a huge impact on their time, more than their names would be mentioned here, very likely. Abraham's name stands out above all the rest of them, as the father of all who believe. Did I get the rest of them? To Eber were born two sons, Peleg. In his days the earth was divided. His brother's name was Joktan. Joktan is important. I think. No, I don't remember where he... Joktan became the father of Almadad, Sheleph, Hazar, Meth, Hazar, Meaveth, Jera, Hadoram, Uzal, Dikla, Obal, Abimelech, Sheba, Ophir, Sheba. Those names ring out. Those are Havilah. Those should be familiar. Arabian Peninsula. Gold of Ophir. Where was the Queen of Sheba from when she visited Solomon? She was down there from rich lady from southern part of Arabia. Jobab. Some people think that Jobab is Job. It's possible that the patriarch Job would mean that Job lived way, way back there about the time of Abraham or so. Jobab, Job. You can speculate on that one and look it up a little bit. Nobody knows for sure. All these were the sons of Joktan. The territory in which they lived extended from Mesha in the direction of Sephar to the hill country of the east. These are the sons of Shem by their families, their languages, their lands, and their nations. These are the families of the sons of Noah according to their genealogies in their nations, and from these the nations spread abroad on the earth after the flood. That's it. That's 70 nations. That's all we know about our early history, just about. You notice that secular histories will sometimes talk about Abraham. You get National Geographic magazines that talk about Abraham as the father of the three monotheistic religions. There's an awful lot of history between here and Abraham. It's a lot. We got a long ways to go. And is this accurate? Yeah, this is accurate. Is it God's word? Yes, it is. Are these real people? Yes, they are. Now, these are real people because chapter 10 is found in 1 Chronicles chapter 1. All these names that are listed here in Genesis 9 are repeated in Chronicles. And Chronicles is this long history of Israel all the way back to the beginning. And that's very, very reliable. So if you don't like Genesis, start in Chronicles. Okay? Any thoughts on this? This is basically it's a wonderful little detective story for somebody that would like to do research. Since I've just pulled out two books, which are the only two books I know of that go into any of the detail here and research this stuff through. But this is not very long ago now. What's my date, Lambert's date for the flood? Nobody believes it, but 3500 B.C. is my date. That's not very long ago. That's 5,500 years ago. That's my date for the flood. So these people weren't that long ago, but nobody thinks in those terms. Anybody got any thoughts, comments, questions on this chunk here?
Has any sort of genetic study been done that, I don't know what you can tell from genetics, to try to group?
Yes. The most interesting genetic studies that I've seen are the ones with respect to Israel. The Jews are very concerned about their heritage, and particularly the Levites have all been identified genetically. There are a group of Levites from Africa, black as midnight from the south part of Africa, that are absolutely for sure Levites. There are also Jews from Japan, from India, from China, that are by blood, by gene, Jewish. So this is really quite a remarkable story. Wait till we get the genome all mapped for everybody. Yeah.
I see where everything is dispersed. So where do the Native Americans of North and South America come from? I don't see that in the list.
There's not on the list, but they're Hamitic peoples.
Which is
from Ham. Now, for example, Egyptians are Hamitic peoples, and they specialize in pyramids.
Yeah, I find that interesting because you have the Aztec Empire, the Inca, the Mayans, great astronomers, great temple builders, and that relates back. And I was thinking about that last week.
Yeah, the Indian people of North and South America then would be Hamitic people in general. How did they get there? Did they get there by boat, or were they on a piece of land that broke off from the rest and drifted over? Possible, in which case they had quite a ride. They probably had a pretty wild ride. And that would show up. All the civilizations in the world have flood legends. They all do. In chapter 9, we talked about that the Japhethites would inherit the legacy of Shem. The flow of religion would go from Israel into Europe, into Western civilization. Didn't go the other way very much. And then there's this exploitation of Ham by everybody else. How have we Japhethites treated the Hamitic people? Terribly. We slaughtered all the American Indians. The Spanish came in and killed almost all the Indians in South America. Africa, the nations of Africa were all colonized and slaves were sold. And the people of China and India and Japan are Hamitic. They come from this, they're called the Sinites in here. You maybe have heard the term Sino-Russian affairs. The Sino is an ancient word for China, and that's their Hamitic peoples.
I thought India was
Japhethite. Oh, no, I forgot India. One branch of Japheth, the Indo-European peoples, one big branch of Japheth went down to India. So the people of India are our cousins. Other people have come in there also. But that's it. It shows up in the language, too.
Are we all related?
We're all related, yeah.
Brothers have the same parents.
Same parents.
We did a genetic thing, which they find after.
Yes. It's pretty well proven now that we're all one race.
Persians are Aryans also. Persians.
Some of the Persians are. Otherwise, yes.
They're very careful to turn up. Point out to you when you go there that they are not Arabs.
That's right. Persians, their language is different.
In 1 John, makes reference to Akkad.
Akkad, yeah.
If I remember correctly, the oldest language that there's
Akkadian.
For is
Akkadians, yeah.
And is that connected to this Akkad?
Yes, that's the Akkadians.
Do you know anything about the Berbers, which are in Algeria?
The Berbers.
Berbers, there.
I don't know.
Well, they insist they're not Arabs either. They were there before the Arabs were there.
Probably. I forgot to tell you, if you get Custance's book, he will show you, for example, how the Hamitic people have invented just about everything that's been invented that's of useful value. They are the ones that found the number zero. They invented algebra. All the gadgets and scientific gear that we have in the world today generally started with the Hamitic people. They're the clever artisans, craftsmen, builders. Pyramids, only the Hamitic people could build pyramids. And the point being here is that God intended three branches in the human race to show us something about ourselves. Are we three-part beings? Do you have an intellectual side, a spiritual side, a physical side? Which is most important? Spiritual. What is least important? Intellectual. So we Japhethites are really, we're kind of low men on the totem pole as far as God's concerned. The people that are ahead of the game are those who devote their life to pursuit of spiritual good things. But we all need each other. God put the human race on here with diversity and with variety, and we need to respect one another. A lot of so-called racial conflict is because we don't understand the differences that God built into the branches of the human race so that we could all work together. That makes sense?
Yes.
And we're just loaded with prejudice and ready to exploit somebody that is not to our liking. Okay, let's stop. And next week we'll do chapter 11. I think that's my last week, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah, I think it is. And you can get on to something useful.
Lord, thanks for that beautiful hymn and that reminder of this time, especially this time of year. And would our minds and hearts be focused on you and what you've done for us? Thank you again for the story of our beginnings. And we look forward to the day when we'll understand it a whole lot better. But we walk now by faith, and as Lambert said, we trust that your word is true. And thank you for that, Father. In Jesus' name, amen.